James is dealing in chapter 3 with the problem of people who have decided that they will try to satisfy their status lust in the church of Jesus Christ without satisfying it on the basis of the gospel. James is particularly concerned about people who are attempting to become leaders in the body that Jesus purchased with his own blood without themselves being convinced that that is significant to them. We'll say this over and over, have said it over and over, but our sense of who we are and of the value that we have as individuals is rooted in the cross, and that's the only place that we should go to try to find it, because it is at the cross that we discover the value that God has placed on us. And frankly, it doesn't matter what anybody else thinks. And even if we are able to get a whole lot of other people to think highly of us, if God doesn't, it doesn't matter. And it doesn't matter how many people don't think highly of us. If God is willing to die for us, then it doesn't matter. He's the only one that's really important. And yet, in James chapter 3, there are apparently some people who don't accept the fact that their value comes from, or their status comes from, God's opinion of them. So they've set about to exalt themselves as wise people in the church. So in verses 13 through 18, as we come to the last paragraph here in the chapter, James is dealing with the question of motivation for ministry and what is really required. In our study last week, in verse 14, we looked into the issue of motivation in the negative side. He talks about having bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your heart. And we particularly focused last week on the fact that James isn't talking here about every kind of ministry in the church, though every kind is subject to this kind of abuse. I mean, people can do things in the church in order to get patted on the back, and that's a lousy motive for doing it. But they can. They can do all kinds of things. But the level of damage that is done is relative to how much influence the position or the thing that they do has. And what James is dealing with in James 3 is not those areas of ministry that only affect portions or parts of the church. He's dealing with that ministry that we've called foundational teaching in the church, because it is teaching that gets men's minds or people's minds moving in a given direction, and they're going to act out of what they believe. So if the teaching is wrong and the faith is wrong, the behavior will be wrong and the damage will be done, and we live in a cause and effect universe, so the harvest will come. Therefore, the issue of motivation is really critical, and in verse 14 we saw that he was dealing with people in the ministry who were bitterly jealous and they had selfish ambition, and that was the reason why they were doing what they were doing. James really doesn't deal with the creedal conclusions of such ministries, but the motives that drive them, and I find that interesting. If you notice through the book of James, James has some doctrinal things that he sets down as fundamental, but most of the time he's dealing, especially in chapter 3, with motives behind the information that's being disseminated. Why doesn't he focus on the issue of what the teachers are teaching is true? He asks the question, verse 13, who among you is wise and understanding? Well, you'd think that the answer would be, well, whoever teaches the word of God correctly. But that's not the answer. The answer is the person who can demonstrate by his behavior that he is consistently committed to following the wisdom of God. That's the meekness of wisdom. The word meekness is simply a word that refers to the person's willingness to submit himself to what God says is true. And you get a track record if you do that. And the track record is what people are supposed to be looking for when they set themselves under somebody to be taught. But in verse 14, he addresses those who would be teachers and questions the motive. And he quite frankly says, bitter jealousy and ambition, selfish ambition, are lousy motives for anything, and particularly for establishing the doctrine of the church. Now, why is it that the motive is so critical? Can't true words, even out of the mouths of improperly motivated people, still result in good if they are believed? If a person says something that's true, even if his motive for saying it is not good, and a person believes that truth, can't good come from that? Sure it can. But that's not the issue. The issue in chapter 3 is what I'm going to call the long-term rubbing shoulders that goes on between teachers and those who listen to them. It's one thing to turn on the radio or TV and hear somebody that you don't know anything about, and so all the input that you get from them is just their words. It's one thing to get input that way. It's another thing, similar to that, to pick up a book that you don't know anything about the author except what's on the fly leaf, and you read through it and you see good doctrinal contents on. It's one thing to get input from those kinds of sources, and those are not nearly as dangerous as the teaching ministry that goes on between persons who are rubbing shoulders with one another week after week after week after week. Because once the shoulder rubbing goes on, words begin to lose the impact that they by themselves have and begin to get mixed with the individual who's speaking them and the motives that are driving them. So if a person is speaking truth improperly motivated, that improper motivation will destroy the impact and the benefit of the word. Words can be divorced from their human sources if there's enough distance between the people, but words that come along with a continual rubbing of shoulders eventually get mixed up with motivation. And the motivations add a kind of content to words.
What about Paul stating something Christ speaks? Obviously, the reason is some brief, but I don't care if it's except Christ be preached.
He rejoiced that Christ is preached, regardless of the motivation of the individual. But he's not at the same time going to encourage people to listen to improperly motivated preachers. At least Christ's name is made better known, even if he's preached out of contention and strife. But I'll guarantee you, the people who sit under those kind of teachings will become contentious and willing to fight. Because that's the motivation that's driving the teaching. Motivations add content to the words and create a certain kind of influence of their own. And by the way, James wasn't writing to churches that had mega numbers. When he wrote these, the people that were getting them were house churches where there were 15 or 20 people that were coming together, rubbing shoulders with one another. They knew each other, and therefore, when the words were spoken, the motivations that were driving them were coloring that entire thing, and it was coloring the house church that it was going on. We've all seen mega ministries where the guy who was doing the work turned out to be involved in fairly serious sin even while he was doing his ministry, and people were still benefiting from the ministry. But the reason's because they were distant from him. There's nothing that undercuts my willingness to listen to somebody than to discover that he's two-faced. It does something to me. I don't want to hear anybody anymore if I find out that while they were writing their book on commitment to Christ, they were carrying on with a woman on the side besides their wife. I don't want to read the book. It does something to me to discover that kind of hypocrisy. And that's what James is driving at here. Motives do affect the words in a close relationship. It's kind of like that old saying that has been around for a long time, I can't hear what you're saying because what you're doing is talking. You're speaking too loud. I didn't say that right, but you know what I'm talking about. It's true. Motivations bleed over into the life. So, verse 15 actually becomes even a more profound statement, because he point blankly says that the wisdom that arises from bitter jealousy and selfish ambition is not from above. Isn't that interesting? He doesn't say wisdom that's not in agreement with the creedal formulations or the truths of the Word of God is not from above. He says the wisdom that is coming out of an improper motivated teacher is not from above. Doesn't matter what he's saying. So what I want to do this evening is to look at this issue of his contention that improperly motivated ministry is not from God, even if it sounds good, looks good, you know, feels good or whatever. If it's not properly motivated, it's not from God. And then I want to look at the contention that it is from some other place. That's what verse 15 says. It's not that which comes down from above, but it's earthly, sensual, and demonic. And it's all based on whether the motivation's proper or not. I find that intensely interesting. I want to say this at the beginning. This isn't the beginning, but... At this point, I want to say this, that we shouldn't sidestep the force of these words, that James is dead serious about this issue of motivation. He is, quite frankly, in this whole section of chapter 3, he's been pretty light in his emphasis upon doctrinal content. When I say that, I realize that he's been saying doctrinal things all the way through, because you really can't say anything without it having some doctrinal impact. But he's been light in the emphasis upon doctrine, and he's been very heavy on his emphasis on where the content's coming from. And that harmonizes with the first century focus upon many deceivers who said the right words. They crept in unawares, and the only way you can do that is if you say the right words. They were saying the right words, but they had a hidden and ungodly agenda in the saying of them. And after a little while, you know, it's that old story of just deviating off the line just a little bit. The further you get, the further away it gets. So if you deviate down here at the motive level, in 10 years, where are you going to be? Or 20. So that's what James is driving at. And his point is exceptionally strong in verse 15, because he just says, if wisdom is not properly motivated, it's from the devil. But he says that teachers are not to be so much accepted by reason of their words or their skill in getting them out, but by reason of the evidence that they get their words from God, because they have a track record of doing what God's told them to do. And that's the bottom line. That's what he said in verse 13. Demonstrate wisdom by the good behavior that comes out of the meekness of wisdom. So let's look at the fact that James said that ministry that's not properly motivated is not from God. Doesn't matter what the words are. The first thing that I want us to look at, James's concept of ministry, when he's talking about teachers in the church. And I've already told you, I feel paranoid teaching this because I'm a teacher in the church. So you're going to have to decide about my motives based on what you see. And that's scary too. But anyway, what is James's real concept of ministry that is from above? He says, this wisdom is not that which comes down from above. So when he talks about wisdom that is coming down from above, or wisdom that's not coming down from above, he's giving us a sense of what he considers ministry to be in relation particularly to the teaching in the church. You remember chapter 1 in verse 5, where he had told us in verses 2, 3, and 4 that when we fell into difficult situations, temptations, and trials, that we were to look forward to the joy that was to be ours if we responded to it properly, and we were to know that the testing of our faith would produce endurance, and that we were to allow endurance to have its complete work in us so that we could be complete. And then in verse 5 he says, and if you don't know what to do, if you lack wisdom, ask of God, who gives to all men generously and without reproach, and it will be given. So James's whole concept of life in this world, living under the reality that there's a God of wisdom, is that we have a need to know what to do today and how to do what we're supposed to do and whether we should do this or that and so on. And our days are filled with the reality that we have to make choices about what to do and what not to do and how to go about doing what we're going to do. And all of that is wisdom related. And he says, if you don't know what to do, ask, and God will give liberally. But the fly in the ointment of verse 5 in chapter 1 is that he tells us God will give us wisdom, but he doesn't tell us how he's going to go about doing it. And it's really interesting. You look at the issues of getting wisdom from God, and it gets kind of complicated. You look at David, for example. The Bible says that David wrote his Psalms under the inspiration of the Spirit of God. He actually wrote prophetic psalms under the inspiration of the Spirit of God, which made him, in a sense, a prophet. And he was a king in Israel. But when you look at the situation in David's life when he needed wisdom from God, you'd think, if he's a prophet, you know, he'll hear voices in his head and God will tell him what he needs to know and he can go about doing it. Because if you're a prophet, you know, you get these divine revelations and... But that's not what happened. Sometimes that happened. Sometimes when David prayed, God gave him an answer, and I guess it came inside of his head. The voice of God, the Spirit working within his mind. But there are times when David needs to know, and God sends a prophet to tell him. Why didn't he just tell him himself? And there are other times when David needs to know and he pulls his counselors together and asks them, what should we do here? Well, no, don't you have a... aren't you an inspired prophet of God? Can't you just get your answers? Apparently not. Or he wouldn't have done it this other way. So when you look at the Old Testament patterns for getting wisdom from God, you discover that God doesn't have a set right way of doing things. Sometimes he will give you an answer inside your head. Sometimes he won't. For example, when we were in Nebraska, we pastored a church that was in a community that was basically elderly and dying. There were four churches in town. Two of them wouldn't bury you if you didn't belong to them. One of them would bury you if you didn't belong to them, but they had a reputation for a little wildfire, and a lot of people didn't want to be buried by those kind of people. So guess who got called to bury all the dead? Yours truly. Not all. I had an average of a funeral a month for 7 years. Yeah, it does. But you know, one of the things that was amazing to me, astounding to me actually, was that many, many times when I would get the call that told me somebody had died and that they wanted our church to do the service, within a matter of sometimes minutes, sometimes hours, but almost invariably before 24 hours went around, I knew what I was going to preach on at the funeral service. So with the demand came an idea. And I just assumed that that was God's helping me to be able to respond to this, because what do you say at a funeral? Nobody knows what needs to be said. So when I needed wisdom from God in that respect, many times it was a thought that came into my mind. I didn't get the counselors together and ask them what to, you know, I didn't ask for a prophet. That's the way it happened. But that's not the only kind of situations that I faced, and that wasn't the only way ever. You know, sometimes you say, God, what do I do here? And there is no sound inside your head. It's a dead silence. And then what do you do? So what I'm saying is, James says God gives generously, but he doesn't say how. Well, in chapter 3, he does say how. Not 100% of the time, but in chapter 3, he says that the teachers in the church are going to be God's conduit of wisdom from himself to people. That's the reason why he's going to hold them so much more accountable in verse 1 of chapter 3. Because what they say is taken to be the wisdom of God for the circumstance of the people, and people are going to do the way they're taught. Well, that's James's concept of ministry. He sees life as the outworking of true wisdom, of being really wise. making choices that work for the long haul. That's what life is. Death is making dumb decisions and living with the consequences. Well, the problem is God is the one who's wise, and men are the one who are responsible in life, and they're going to suffer or benefit depending. And the conduit of wisdom that takes the wisdom of God to men is fundamentally the teaching ministry of the church. That's one reason why many, many, many times people don't get the answers that they need, because they're not willing to plug into where God's pouring out the answers. So that's what chapter 3 is all about, is men over here who want to be patted on the back for being good teachers. They want other men to give them glory, so they're looking to be in this position so they can get that. Well, that's a terrible motivation for ministry, and I wish that it'll never happen until the millennium. But I really do wish that everybody who didn't have an inner compulsion in their gut telling them that God wanted them doing this would just quit. It'd make the teaching of the church a whole lot less complicated. There wouldn't be nearly as much confusion. But there is this thing called bitter jealousy and selfish ambition, and it's pervasive in religion, and so we have confusion like crazy. Well, this is James's concept of ministry. It's getting the wisdom of God to the men who need it. And the conduit of wisdom is fundamentally the teaching ministry of the church. That's what he's driving at. And that's why he says in verse 15, this wisdom is, I'm going to drop the knot out for a minute. His concept of ministry is wisdom coming down from above. It's all present tense. The idea is that it's descending. It's continuously coming. That's why James says, God gives to all men liberally and upbraideth not. When I was a junior in high school, I went up to wheat harvest in Oklahoma to work for my uncle. And that was back in the days when the combines had no cabs and no air conditioning. And the wheat chaff would blow in the wind and it'd go down your neck and it'd itch like crazy. And you'd do this for 16 hours a day. And when they finally shut the combine off, you go to the house. And they didn't have indoor plumbing, but they had this tank up off the ground about as high as the ceiling that the windmill filled. And there was a little hose that came out the bottom and came into this little room that you could stand in. And you could just stand under there and the water would run over you. Well, the conduit of the wisdom of God is the wisdom of God, liberal. God gives liberally. He pours the wisdom through this conduit, and all you got to do is get under it. That's the picture of ministry that James has. But he says, not if it's improperly motivated. Verse 15 says, this wisdom is not. The wisdom that is motivated by bitter jealousy and selfish ambition is not flowing from God. It's not flowing from God. So where is it coming from? Well, it says there's three descriptive terms in verse 15 that he characterizes improperly motivated teaching ministries by. He says, number one, they're earthly. What's that mean? Well, that word is used throughout the New Testament to refer to something that's made out of dirt. And what he's talking about is earthly as opposed to heavenly. He talks about the celestial bodies and the earthly bodies. He talks about our earthly tabernacle being torn down and having a tabernacle in heaven, bodies. But basically, earthly means that it's time-bound wisdom. And what I mean by that is it's wisdom that allows eternity to be displaced by the paltry concerns of now. Again, I had a friend in Nebraska years ago. I used to help him harvest his alfalfa hay. You know, I was pastor and I didn't work but one day a week. So I drove the tractor and run the sickle bar, cut the hay. And then a few hours after the sun had beat down on it, his wife would start raking it and I'd start pushing it and he'd start stacking it. And many, many times he was tempted to put up hay and skip the services of the church. And he'd say, but you know, 50 years from now, it won't matter at all whether I got this hay up. But it will matter what he sacrificed in the process. And that's the kind of thing that happens with earthly wisdom. It says, this is more important than eternity. This that I want to do now is more important than what it'll create forever. And that's earthly wisdom. When eternity is sacrificed on the foolish and minor issues of this world, it's earthly wisdom. The second word that he uses is translated in the New American Standard, natural, but that word comes from the word soul, and I'm going to call it soulish. It's the word that's translated carnal or natural by Paul in the Corinthian epistles. But the word soul is almost invariably throughout the scriptures referring to the emotional aspect of our makeup. So soulish wisdom is emotion-bound wisdom. What's emotion-bound wisdom? Well, it's the kind of wisdom that you get from deciding things on the basis of the way you feel. And you know how dangerous that is? You get up in the morning and your caffeine levels, and you feel, and you have to make a decision and you do it on the basis of the way you feel, guess what you're going to end up doing? By the same token, a couple hours later, you got 3 cups of coffee and your caffeine levels up, you feel good, and a decision comes along, and because you feel a certain way, you decide, and you don't ask God, you just decide. Well, that's emotion-bound wisdom, and it exalts the warm fuzzies over the far more critical issues of whether God is in favor of this action or not. And in our generation, we are being overrun by emotion-bound wisdom. They're even calling worship now the generation of the emotion stuff. And I have absolutely no problem with good music, and I have no problem with warm fuzzies. I love them. But they're not a good foundation for making decisions. Emotion's what makes life worth experiencing. But you try to save that or make your decisions on the basis of it, and you'll discover that you don't have the ability to do that. You'll sow all kinds of stuff that'll come back on you emotionally. And he says that it's emotion-bound. And then finally, he gives it one more characteristic. He calls it demonic. You know, Paul talked about seducing spirits and doctrine of demons. Well, what is the essence of demonic wisdom? How did demons get to be demons? They were angels who wanted more. They wanted their status on some other basis than what God had granted. Well, isn't that what's going on in chapter 3? People who want to be teachers in the church so they can have status that's not based at Calvary. Anytime we get our sense of who we are and how valuable we are from any place except Calvary, we're into demonic wisdom already. And basically, demonic wisdom is self-glory bound. I want glory to come to me. And that exalts glory that men have to offer over the glory that God has to offer. And so we have time-bound wisdom, emotion-bound wisdom, glory-bound wisdom. All of it is not from God at all. And the thing that's so important about verse 15 is that he doesn't say anything at all about what they're saying. He just talks about why they're saying it. So that the motive is critical. Improperly motivated ministry is from this earth. It's natural and demonic. It has nothing to do with getting the wisdom of God to the minds and hearts of men so they can make wise choices. In order for this conduit to be open, the person who's involved in the teaching has got to be interested in being God's instrument to get wisdom to the hearts and minds of men so their lives can be improved. He cannot have any other motivation that centers around himself, because that's demonic. It can't be centered around how he feels, because that's soulish. It can't be centered around the moment rather than eternity, because that's time-bound. It's earthly. Those kind of motivations will corrupt even good words over time. So, in the church, and that's what James is writing about here. We want to be real careful that we don't submit ourselves to teaching that is not established according to verse 13, the meekness of wisdom, because other motivated ministry will eventually corrupt us and eat our lunch in the long run. Okay, we're out of time. Anybody have any comment or question they want to make before we quit? No, no. Just get under the conduit. Don't go home, crawl in bed. Go over there and get under that conduit. A horse tank. Yeah, well, you got all the cold water all at once. I just got it in a little stream. Well, James is a hard-hitting book, though. You know, everybody that reads it recognizes that. But his heart is his burden is that God's pouring out of his wisdom will not be corrupted by men who are simply looking for something else besides that and using their place in that for their own self-interest. I would like to think so, but it could get worse. I mean, you know, if you look at the prophetic picture, it's going to get worse.
How about I think in a different way?
And, well, we have begun...
Saturated the airways with this stuff.
Oh, yeah. And I think that we've also begun to see God's reaction to that because he's brought down ministries that were improperly motivated. He lets them go for a while and then he brings them down because he's not satisfied with that. Even the letter to the church in Ephesus in Revelation 2, improperly motivated doctrinal, he said, I'll take your lampstand away. You don't get this straightened out.
I was just talking earlier there too about the number of churches that have empty pulpits today. They're looking for pastors.
Mm-hmm.
But there are an awful lot of pastors that are occupying pulpits that are improperly motivated.
You bet.
What you were suggesting in the past, there'd be a lot more empty pulpits.
That's true. That's true. Well, that's true too. People do have itching ears on occasion. They heap to themselves teachers, tell them what they want to hear. Yeah, that's true. Well, you know, people being people. Well, I think I told some of you about the ad in the Christianity Today. This group of people wanted to start a seeker-sensitive church. And they, in their ad, they said, we want a killer leader, and if you're worth it, money's no object. You know what they're going to get? They're going to get a killer leader who will take them to the cleaners. That's what they're going to get, because that's what they're looking for. Well, that's pitiful. No, not at all. Anything else? Well, that's our word of prayer, then we'll be dismissed. Father, as we interact with your word, we know that your spirit is capable of taking these truths and giving us your wisdom. And you know that we need to be motivated by your wisdom. We thank you for your gracious work in making wisdom available to us by many methods and means. And we pray, Father, that we'll continue to seek you for the wisdom that we need and that you'll continue to provide it. For we ask these things in Jesus' name.